Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect, believe it or not, is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust back in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, assault course, an assault course anyway, but not the sort you'd expect, with David Moat. Also, we hear from John Stockwell. He's a CIA whistleblower from the 1980s, and we review some of the news stories with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733. Find them on the web too at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But I'm joined this week, to start with, by David Moat from the Assault Course. But David, this is not your average kind of army-type assault course. You're not going to get muddy or bruised, we hope.
Well, you might get muddy on an allotment. I suppose you could get bruised by falling over a plant pot. But it's not that kind of assault course, no. But the pun is intended. This assault is a salt course, and SALT, S-A-L-T, stands for Spiritual Activist Leadership Training. The spiritual bit is not about contacting your granny in a sort of different sort of church.
You're not spiritualists, then.
We're not spiritualists, no. It's spiritual in the sense of trying to avoid the R word, the religious. It's finding something that underpins a lot of people's attitudes to life, something mysterious, something connecting. Some people are pagans, some people are Buddhists, and some people are atheists but have a, you know, deep sort of intuitive take on life. So it's about finding that which sustains activism.
And it sounds religious, though. I mean, what you're saying, it, to me, just sounds religious. What do you mean when you say it's not religious, or you're actually against the R word?
The emphasis is on the activism, is on political activists. But in my experience, I don't know about you, Tony, I've often been in situations where I've fought a campaign with my own ego, or simply on a political level, and I find that by drawing on deeper resources than I have myself as an individual, I can sustain what I do. I can keep coming at it, something from a place of joy and hope rather than sort of despair and anger.
So are you talking about a sort of Jesus or Gandhi figure rather than the actual, you know, the sort of, when you say religion, you tend to think of a sort of church building or the rules of the church, that kind of thing?
Yeah, certainly not institutional church, but in our society, people have found their own ways to having a set of values that sustain them. Some people just meditate. On this current cohort, there is someone who has been a lifelong adherent of transcendental meditation. That's his thing. In previous courses, have been Buddhists, Jews, atheists. In my case, I'm a Quaker. And that was something that helped me through a difficult moment when I was working in the occupied territories in Palestine.
Now, for a lot of people, the spiritual side comes when adversity comes into their life. But that's not necessarily the greatest introduction to spirituality, is it?
No, it reminds me of someone who used to call himself a nighttime Catholic. He was raised a Catholic and he only went back to it in a crisis. No, that's not the best way. Best way is to have some kind of practice, whether in good times or bad times, that keeps people going. In recent years, I've been jogging regularly in the morning, or as a musician, I practice my trumpet, and that's maybe just on a physical level that keeps me going, keeps my breathing and sort of body intact. And
well, you know what? It's almost an act of faith, isn't it? Because especially practicing something, it's almost like it's very difficult to get through sometimes to young people how valuable that can be, because they can't see any kind of immediate result.
Yeah, it's sort of a bit of a paradox, because there isn't an immediate result. You're doing something that doesn't isn't about getting a result tomorrow, but at the same time, there is immediate benefit from if I practice my trumpet in the morning for half an hour, I have got a good attitude buzz about the day. It does physically help me through the day. I mean, it's a very physical thing.
Good exercise for your lungs too, David.
It's good exercise for my lungs. It's the sound. I play long notes, slurry. It's deadly boring for my neighbours.
It wakes them up. What time do you do it? 7 a.m.
I don't. I would not say where I live in case they come and get me. No, so I only start about 9 in the morning. So there you go. I'm one of those activists that don't start the day, you know, in the early hours plotting my campaign. I'm fairly civilised in the way I do things.
Okay, so how does this fit into what actually happens on the assault course?
Well, everyone comes with their own need, agenda, campaign, project. For example, we have people interested so far this year. A couple of people are very into supporting Palestine, solidarity with Palestinians. Someone else, as I already described, is into transcendental meditation, and he seems to be, from talking to him, a connector, a catalyst who brings people together. In fact, he calls himself the whistling catalyst because he enjoys it so much, and he goes away with a whistle when two people connect who wouldn't otherwise have done. Someone else I don't know much about yet. She's a Quaker from North Somerset, and she's told me a bit about a food co-op that she was trying to start up. Someone else wants to start up a social enterprise for creators. Everyone's got their own project. Activism is very broadly defined.
It's very difficult, though, I think, in the current climate with austerity and adversity, actually, to persuade people that it's worthwhile. It sometimes seems that even though activism of all sorts is probably more necessary in a difficult social climate, that actually it's difficult to get the morale up to want to do it and to see, to actually believe in yourself that you can see it through.
Well, as a wise person once said, those who have ears to hear, let them hear. And I'm finding by putting the word out through Facebook, word of mouth, emails, texting, I'm finding the people who are interested and can already see the point. Other people, it's up to them. I'm not in the business of trying to persuade people. I'm in the business of communicating to people who have a yen for doing something, who are already stuck in and can see the danger of getting burnt out. That's the core thing. It's for people who are engaged in change work, who realise the risks of being isolated, getting burnt out, followed by depression, followed by some other, you know, going away from it for a while and then getting back in for the next fix, the next adrenaline rush. Because we're in this game for the long term. Activism, as someone once said, is really, it's real democracy, it's deep democracy. It's actively making sure that the bare mechanics at which we've got in this country and elsewhere actually function, actually turn around, so that people are really engaged as people, as citizens, with each other, with local authorities, with governments, and internationally. And that's the purpose of it, is to help sustain, help nurture activism.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks, because everything costs something. How much is this going to cost people if they're interested? And where are you getting any help with funding, that sort of thing?
Well, as of today, I've just been given the all clear by the Schumacher Institute, which is the host organisation, to set up a bursary fund. So my next step is to ask for perhaps yesterday's activists who are slightly better off to be, you know, who's sympathetic with what I'm trying to do, and who can set up who can contribute to a bursary fund. And the Schumacher Institute is a registered charity. It can accept gift aid. And that way I will be able to subsidise activists who are hard up. And there's a number of people who've shown interest in this, but just like you're implying, they've said, we can't afford it. The current charge for the year is £600 for a year, which translates into one meeting a month, but with mentoring and support. So if I take on a group, I'm a kind of facilitator and mentor to those people through the year, so that we meet together, but I will also assist in between times as well. It's like being a sort of, I don't know, a godparent or a friend to them for their journey through that year as they focus on their goals and sustaining themselves and sharing their ideas with the group.
Yeah, but for a lot of people who may have a lot of zeal to get involved, £600 is a lot of money.
That's exactly right. So having aimed to start this coming weekend, which is why I'm here, I had to make the decision. There's been some pre-meetings, so I couldn't make the decision until I had a clear picture. I've made the decision to delay the start for a month, which will be the 23rd of February. It's a Sunday evening. And use that time to set up this bursary fund through my contacts, through the Quakers, for example, through other groups, to set up a fund so that it won't cost £600 for those who need that support. It's a case of those who can afford to pay and those who can't but really want to do it will find a way to help them do the course.
Okay, for £600 or less, if you can manage it, you're saying Sunday evenings. When are your meetings taking place each week and where?
They're taking place once a month at the end of the month. 23rd of February, Sunday evening, is the beginning. But then it's all day Monday, and that's the pattern each time. It's always a Sunday evening to have a share around, you know, shared food, get together. And then Monday is a packed day with a mixture of sessions that people run themselves. Some sessions I run. Sometimes it's about practical work on an allotment, because that's partly what sustains people. It's also about shared spiritual practices. Some people might offer meditation, other people something else, some creative approaches as well. And it takes place, at least the initial and meeting point will be the Palestine Museum in Broad Street in Bristol, which is above a venue known as the Ark Bar, which has been around for a few years.
That's on Broad Street, isn't it?
It's in Broad Street. All the details are on the Schumacher Institute website.
Okay. Now, this isn't the first SALT course you've run.
No, I've run it several times before, and it went well, but it wasn't sustainable because I couldn't afford to keep going, basically, at the time. We got to a point where no one was paying anything, which was great at the time, but I then had to get on and with my self-employment, with my freelance work, and I couldn't sustain it. So I've reintroduced a more conventional element, which is money, because I need it to be able to sustain this sort of work and give it my time.
Now, give us some examples of where people have gone or on to do things that they've gone on to do after your previous courses.
Well, for example, Maren Connolly, who has been very involved in Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, became the chair of the group for a while and became a director of East Side Roots in Eastern. Someone else was very new to astrology when he joined the course and tested out various ideas with us. He's now a leading astrologer living in Glastonbury. By the end of it, there's a very strong group of people who care for each other, look out for each other, give each other critical feedback. It's not just a nice, you know, fluffy thing. People, there's been conflict in the group. There's one woman who went on to be a mentor for others. And I remember her and other participants. I haven't discussed it with them, so I can't reveal their names. But I remember them really having quite a lot of conflict in the group. And one of them told me afterwards that she learnt the value of conflict, that it's something that you can contain and learn from, and it wasn't just a problem. And she's applied that in her work subsequently.
Well, because people avoid conflict, don't they? This is the thing, and sometimes that conflict's necessary for them to move on. I mean, maybe to do with being bullied at work, this kind of thing. There's all sorts of reasons why conflict actually can have a positive side to it. So please, folks, don't always see differences of opinion as a bad thing. In fact, I think, you know, if someone like a newspaper editor, I mean, if we can go to that level in this discussion, they should be having all sorts of different opinions and not be afraid to have on the same page of a newspaper two completely opposing views. And opposing views can actually be a real catalyst for change, you know, which is obviously one of the things you're after. Okay, finally, just give us a dip into the sort of Monday. Give us an idea of what, if I was to be a fly on the wall one Monday on the sort course, what would I be seeing?
You'd be seeing, in the morning, you'd be seeing three sessions of roughly an hour each with energizers in between, which were led by the different participants. So, for example, I might do something on a technique or a piece of theory around activism that related, in my judgment, to a number of the campaigns or work that the participants were doing. Someone else might lead a session where they were testing something that they were going to try out in real life in their activism in a week or two hence.
It's sort of role play.
They were trying it out on us to see our feedback, and then they would tweak it and refine it and apply it. Or someone else might be evaluating something that didn't go very well, and they want to find out in a safe space why that was. So we would be giving critical feedback and suggestions. That's helpful. Then we'd have a shared lunch, and then we'd go off to the allotment. Which is really important part of the work, because one of the things that happens with activists, we go off in our heads, we live a kind of accelerated life and forget that we're part of a natural cycle. As human animals, as creatures, we need to relate to the natural cycle. There's a natural time to do things and a time not to do things. Sometimes things need to seem to be dead and buried for a while until, after a while, miraculously, you get new growth.
We've just heard this week in the news about night workers, their body clock absolutely destroying a lot of their body chemistry if they're having to work at night time. Yeah. It just isn't the way we were designed.
Absolutely. So by working on an allotment, it's not about learning how to do gardening. It's more being in that environment and having discussions with each other as we're weeding or composting, whatever it is.
Conflict over which what should be planted where.
Yeah. it could well be. And somewhat disingenuously, I'm offering my allotment. Of course, what I'm going to get out of it is a bunch of people who are going to help make it happen.
I and never some leaks maybe.
Yeah, it's some leaks of all kinds on the compost heap and planted, and we all get to share the produce.
Well, there's something very primal in a weird way about an allotment. I mean, it might sound silly, but I mean, we're all, I think, all of us would like to have a bit of land to grow a little bit of something on, even if it's a tree to plant when we're younger, to see it grow as we get older, and to have maybe a little bit of a mixture of perennial and annual plants to nurture. The tragedy, of course, is that most people actually nowadays do not have a piece of land they can call their own, somewhere that they can grow and nurture, because we're living in this kind of rent economy. Mm. So the situation is actually, it's making life difficult for us. Mm. I mean, we've had all the discussions again in the news this week about the pressures on young people nowadays. We've got something like 1.2 million unemployed between the ages of 16 and 25 now, and this is really taking its toll on mental health.
Absolutely. It's a very healthy... When I go to the allotment, I find, but just for myself, it's a very healthy place to be, to actually listen to some bird song, and the pride I have when I come back with my three or four slightly diminutive beetroots, you know, back to my wife and toddler, it's a proud moment. I love it. And if I've got a surplus of lettuce, it's great to be able to give a few to neighbours. So yeah, it's a really healthy place to be, just to have your hands in earth. Even before things have started growing.
Well, it's a start of what I think we're going to need in the future at some point, David, because, you know, we're living in a world with little food security. Yeah. I mean, the whole supermarket system can't last forever. And we've got 55, roughly 60 million acres of land in Britain and around about the same number of people. So at some point, these big landowners like the Duke of Westminster, I think, are going to have to give up some of their property.
Absolutely. And do you remember in I think it was in 2000 when the... oil tanker drivers went on strike, and food supplies in many supermarkets were perilously low, to close to running out. And it's exactly that's exactly the reason for this sort of course, because my vision is, it's also an educational model, you see, because my vision is, rather than depending on these massive institutions that seem to have overnight opted for a money-based maximum, you know, let's get the maximum out of these consumer students that we're allowed, seem to kind of overnight go on the dark side, all these universities one after the other. This is another way of doing education. Critical, deep, thorough-based learning, but we do it for each other. We don't need the professor with a string of letters to do it in a big 60s, you know, type institution off on some campus and pay loads of money for it. We can do it for each other. And as you say exactly, that's right, we'll need to, because we need that kind of resilience, resourcefulness, flexibility and reflection on all the things you're talking about. It's about reflecting on real life and bringing that into these Mondays. We've got a bit of space outside activism. If you just have activism after activism, you burn out. That's my personal experience. But a bit of space, some support and some care for each other, and we can sustain what we do and show people a model of how to do things.
And also, if you talk about it as around about £10 or £12 a week, it doesn't sound quite so much.
That's right.
So anyway, tell us how to get in touch with you if people are interested in finding out more about the
course. Well, the first thing I'd suggest is to go onto the www.schumacherinstitute.org.uk/assault, A-S-A-L-T. Otherwise, you can ring me. I'm actually, you just Google my name. You're bound to find my details. I'm pretty much out
okay,
there.
Okay, David Mowat. You better spell your second name in.
Mowat.
Okay, David. Just finally remind us of the website. And, you know, good luck with your course. It'd be interesting maybe if you could come back in a year's time and tell us how you got on with it. Or even, if you'd like to, come along at some point between now and a year's time if you want. And we can have a chat to some of your activists if you'd like us to.
Fantastic. I'm all for spreading this model. It's very low-tech, reproducible, systems-based. This is the thing that Schumacher contribute to it, that they're very good on systems thinking. I've not the place to go into it, but I'm sure in one of your future programs, Tony, you'd be...
Come on, tell us, what is systems thinking?
Systems thinking, my goodness, you've put me on the spot now. It's about doing... It's about being and doing several different things all at once and finding that the result is more than the sum of the parts. I mean, that's one of the things. It's a synergy, which means we're more than the sum of the parts.
Force multiplication.
False multiplication.
Have you not heard of that? That's one word I've heard that described.
Oh, right.
If you've got two or three people all working on the same project, yeah, that... Actually, they seem to manage to do 10 times the work of one person somehow. But it's just the way human beings are made.
Yeah, it is. It's our brains are systems based. They're networked. They're not about having chains of command from one end to the other end. You know, I am thirsty, but the other end I pick up a glass and I drink. It's far more complex and immediate than that with systems thinking. Systems thinking is merely thinking which is beginning to understand the way nature, the way systems, ecosystems work, the complexity of interaction. At the heart of it is mystery. We don't know how these things work, but it's about trusting that a multiplicity of approaches, of values, of leaders, if you like, initiatives, can come up with something creative and sort of that works.
Okay, well,
that's a rather vague
description. It sounds vague, but it makes a lot of sense. Listen, I'll just reread the website out if people are online. That's for the Schumacher Institute. That's S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H-E-R Institute, INSTITUTE.org.UK/ASALT, ASALT. The course, Nourishment for Change Agents. Who is it for? Is its title. And you'll see far more information on there, including contact details for David. That is BigBromo, B-I-G, on email, B-R-O-M-O, Big Brother Moat, is that?
That's right. That's right.
The easiest way to remember it. Yeah. Or you can ring or text 07804-363-170. That's 07804-363-170. David, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony, for having me. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now, one thing must stop if our government is to regain our respect and that of the rest of the world, and that is state-sanctioned torture. By keeping torture secret, the US and British governments think they can get away with it. But even with the recent revelations about extraordinary rendition, they've proved why the government culprits haven't yet been jailed, that they can get away with it. Whistleblowers cause massive problems for these criminals, though, and a great example is from the 1980s, the former CIA case officer John Stockwell. And here he is speaking on Alternative Views News magazine from the mid-1980s.
A lot of people have been involved with the CIA over the years. Alternative Views News magazine.
We have with us tonight John Stockwell, the former CIA case officer who's back for an encore performance. We're going tonight to discuss the On Company Business, the documentary film that has been made recently about the CIA.
John, and we'll be seeing some sections of that film tonight.
Right. I should have mentioned that earlier. We have a few clippings that we will discuss and comment on. And we're also going to discuss John Stockwell's court case, where the government is suing him because he allegedly broke his contract or oath with the CIA not to disclose any information about their operations. What was the Supreme Court decision that's the basis of the government's harassment of you now?
Well, Frank Snepp wrote a book similar to mine about the collapse of South Vietnam and the scandal of the U.S. evacuation of South Vietnam in 1975. And he, like me, did not submit the book for CIA review or censorship for the obvious reason they would not have let him publish the entire story. As a result, the CIA sued him in a test case. The reason they picked him was because his book came out before mine by a few months. And then when mine came out, they said that they would have preferred, they wished they'd waited and gotten me instead. For technical reasons, my case would have been more interesting to them, and actually it would have been more interesting to me. I think I could have made a better fight than Frank Snepp did of it. But they took it to their favorite court in Alexandria, Virginia, where the judges are notoriously biased in favor of the agency, flagrantly.
That's right next door to them.
Right next door. The statements the judges made during the trial, like early on, that the facts of the case didn't interest him one damn bit. Mispronouncing Frank Snepp's name repeatedly during the trial, interrupting on behalf of the district attorney, the prosecution, to protest testimony that the judge didn't like was going on. He would say objection sustained when there had been no objection, and things like this throughout the trial. And then, perhaps the most incredible of all, when Snepp tried to get waiting to get the transcript of some of the incredible statements that were made in court through the transcript of the proceedings, found that they had been expunged. So they were not part of the court record, even though all of the attorneys and journalists present were witness that they had been said. And the CIA taking Snepp to this court, the judge referred during the proceedings to Frank Snepp's ill-gotten gains from his book, and ruled heavily in favor of the government, that Snepp should have to pay the government everything he'd earned from the book.
Even though Snepp never did reveal any information that was classified.
They never claimed that he had revealed a single secret. Their point was that he had signed a contract with the government not to attack the government without the government's permission, and therefore his book was illegal, a breach of contract, and that he, by signing that, had waived all of his First Amendment rights. He no longer had freedom of speech. The appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, ruled in the CIA's favor, But they ruled that that a judge, a federal judge, could not affix the damages, that a jury would have to affix the damages, that the judge could award the government $1 from Frank Snap. The Supreme Court, in a decision this last January, which was described in the dissenting opinion as unique in the history of the Supreme Court, it refused to hear the case. It refused to hear Frank Snap's arguments or the government's arguments, but it ruled in favor of the government. It ruled, it gave the government more power than it had asked for. Beyond that, it legislated new law. It's supposed to interpret existing law, but it ruled in its written statement that its objective was to create a situation, a law that would protect the confidentiality it considered necessary to the functioning of the CIA. Now, that clearly is the Congress's responsibility to legislate new law. But it did rule that, and we are now stuck with the Snap decision. Snap is having to pay back $120,000 from proceeds of his book. 3 weeks later, the government initiated its lawsuit against me to deprive me of my ill-gotten gains.
You're going to stop having parties and give away back all those Rolls Royces and stuff like that you've been getting,
yeah? Yeah. We laughed, actually. The government was not aware of the fact that a book like that does not make that much money. And 3 years, the money is long since spent. 3 years in my travel and research costs and my taxes, and the money is spent. And I lived, as you well know, quite modestly during the interim.
John, what are the implications of this Supreme Court decision? What does this mean vis-a-vis First Amendment rights and government secrecy and suppression of information from the public?
Well, it means very simply that in that decision that the Supreme Court has upset the delicate balance of power on which our government functions. It means that people, according to their law, their ruling, people who have worked for the government, whether or not you signed an agreement, even if you did not sign an agreement, you have a fiduciary responsibility not to attack the government without its permission if you've worked for the government. If you do, they cannot, under that ruling, put you in jail, but they can sue you for whatever damages a judge without a jury decides to stick you with. Now, that means, for example, that, see, the CIA is an office of the White House, and that means that the president has in his power to do incredible things, as the CIA has, truly incredible things, depraved things, and people who know what these secrets are not allowed to speak out about it, much less do anything about it, is quite literally an official secrets ruling. It's not an act of Congress, but it's an act of the Supreme Court. Under this ruling, they cannot put you in jail, but they can sue any former government employee for damages if he attacks the government. Now, by attacking the government, mind you, I didn't write a book calling for a violent overthrow of the government. I wrote a book which exposed a war the CIA had done in Angola, an irresponsible war in which 10,000 people were killed needlessly, not even to protect our national security, and about Henry Kissinger and William Colby lying to the Congress to cover up that war. I felt that I was in a position where my bosses had consciously and flagrantly defied the Constitution and were functioning as a secret police separate, apart, and above the Constitution. And I struggled with my conscience at length, but I decided that if it comes down to loyalty to the CIA and loyalty to the Constitution, you must choose in favor of the Constitution. I was wrong, according to our Supreme Court. It is the heaviest blow to the First Amendment in the history of this country.
It's also very interesting that the people like the ACLU, Civil Liberties Union, and the press have roundly criticized the Supreme Court for this decision. What was the vote, by the way, in the court? Do you remember what it was?
Three dissenting opinions.
So this is sort of Nixon's revenge, the Supreme Court on the American people.
Well, I must say, though, that this is really not an unusual attack. We've seen from the Trilateral Commission, the book Crisis of Democracy, indicating that they want legislation to do just what the Supreme Court has done. Mm-hmm. And the Senate Bill 1 and the son of Senate Bill 1, which have been pushed so hard by Senator Kennedy, mm-hmm. and which has been fought so much by, and successfully so far by, the ACLU, also would legalize exactly mm-hmm. what the Supreme Court has already done. So it isn't that the Supreme Court is such a maverick in this sense.
Wasn't there another bizarre decision that came a week or two, or shortly after the SNEP decision? And that is, didn't the Supreme Court give Henry Kissinger the right to use secret government documents when he was Secretary of State to write a book that he was writing, and moreover, not to let any other scholars even look at them, to sort of withhold them from the Freedom of Information Act? Could you comment on this and some of the implications of this Kissinger decision?
This was also verbalized by the judge in the Frank Stemp case, who stated that it was his opinion that high-level government employees should be free to write books and whatnot, but middle and lower-level employees should not. And read that if you are a high-level employee and you write something that is patently false and full of lies, it's okay. If it's an apology for the crimes you've committed or those around you have committed, it's okay. But if you're someone who is in the middle levels, deeply involved in what really happened, and want to tell the American public about what was done with our tax dollars, often to the American public, that is not permissible.
Well, speaking of telling about the CIA and what is happening in it, this movie, which we'll see parts this evening, is really one of the most effective pieces of filmmaking I've ever seen. It just hits you emotionally time and time again. How did it happen? How did it all start?
Well, you know, I wasn't involved in it in any way in its production. I was just interviewed on it for an hour or two, but we do have someone with us here by extraordinary good luck and good fortune who was very much involved. Molly Doherty is from Austin and happens to be visiting in town, and she helped Alan Frankovich get this film moving.
How long did it take Alan to make this movie, or the whole film crew? Molly, it's an extraordinary collection of newsreels, of interviews. It must have taken a long time to make. How long was he working on this?
I think he was working on it close to 7 years, and a lot of the problem was it's not just an extraordinary amount of research involved in such a film in order that every detail be totally accurate and corroborated by several sources, but also that he had to spend a lot of time fundraising because he couldn't find anybody to financially back up the movie.
Nobody put up $1 million
to
do it?
Gulf and Exxon weren't interested learning about the CIA?
No, they weren't very supportive. And the movie cost altogether around $350,000, and that was mostly raised in $50, $100, and a few $1,000 increments. So that's one reason the film took so long to make.
Where has it been shown? I know it's been here on PBS.
It's been around the country on PBS.
And what about outside the country?
Well, it's shown at Cannes Film Festival last week, I believe.
What was the reaction there?
I haven't heard yet.
At the Berlin Festival, it won the Critics Award.
Yeah, it won the Critics Award for the best movie.
It's unbelievable, some of the material they have. Even a tape recording of the Tupamaro guerrillas holding the CIA butcher and talking to him, and you can see him denying that he's, and you hear him denying that he's a member of the CIA, and talking about how sorry he is that people are going to be hurt, and here he was involved in torturing and training other people to torture.
Incredible. You know, it's been said in the reviews of this movie that trying to document for a film CIA past secret operations is like trying to catch a vampire's image in the mirror. You know, it seems to be impossible. But these filmmakers, by interviewing people and taking film clips of situations, what really happened, and working very, very hard for a long period of time, have come up with incredible documentation. Not one reviewer that I've read has challenged the accuracy or authenticity of any point they make in this film.
Former CIA case officer John Stockwell there, relating his experiences of working within the US intelligence services. Sounds like they picked up pretty much where the Nazis left off, doesn't it? More from John in future weeks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now, Now it's time to do our weekly look at the news with Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello, Tony. Now,
first of all, first number one on the list is patient records. Now, this sounds to me as if it might have something to do with various of our records that doctors keep for us in confidence.
Yes, I'm afraid it might not be in confidence for much longer. Drug and insurance companies will from later this year be able to buy information on patients, including mental health patients and patients' diseases such as cancer, as well as smoking and drinking habits, once a single English database of medical data has been created.
Right, so this is what they're planning at the moment, is to bring all of people's medical data out of our medical surgeries and into one big central database. Now, I imagine this is the wonderful Jeremy Hunt's work, because he seems to be the guy who's, well, he's the health secretary at the moment. Now, first of all, you know, I certainly don't want any of my private patient data brought into some sort of central database. Everything seems to be going into these databases nowadays. What are your thoughts about, would you mind something like that, Jason?
Well, I'd rather not. You know.
We do get an opt-out, apparently, so I would suggest that anyone is concerned about this speaks to their doctor. Now, the problem here being several-fold, because if your private medical data gets into the hands of insurance companies, you may find it impossible to get insurance, life insurance, medical insurance or whatever. So that's why one reason why you might not wish to. And of course, an insurance company, they may wish to buy data from this to run a check on you if you ever apply for insurance. So, you know, this is a really pernicious, potentially, concept going on here. Jason, what are your thoughts? Would you like to opt out, or would you be allowing your data to be shared in this super database?
I will definitely opt out. I mean, I hate the idea that my data, my medical record, is open to all forms of companies, drug companies, insurance companies. It also mentions in the article there's a small risk that certain patients could be re-identified because insurers, pharmaceutical groups and other health sector companies have their own records.
Ah, right. So what they'd be doing is cross-referencing and finding you that way. Even if, I mean, this is the, you've got the copy of The Guardian there. This is the front page lead story in The Guardian, one of the editions this week. And also the Daily Telegraph goes big on this. It says, Philip Johnson, who writes for The Telegraph, "Don't mislead us about our NHS medical records. The NHS wants us to hand over our personal health details, yet it cannot guarantee anonymity," he says. "By the end of this month, every household in England should have received a leaflet from the NHS entitled Better Information Means Better Care. When it drops on the mat, you'd be forgiven for thinking it was just junk mail, but don't throw it away. It represents the biggest change yet to the way our personal health records are handled. From March, these are to be extracted from GP surgeries and made available to something called the Health and Social Care Information Centre. It will load them onto its database known as Care Data." Now, this is happening. Yes, you can opt out. But one of the things that Philip Johnson is saying is, why on earth, if they're mailing everybody in the country to tell them about this, don't they also mail as part of it an opt-out form? So it looks as if you're the sort of person that doesn't normally, you know, isn't going regularly to your doctor every month or whatever, which is most of us, that you have to actually go into either phone or go into your local surgery in order to opt out if you don't want your information to go. Because once it's gone, Jason.
And I think the main problem I have with this whole idea is that in the future, private companies could access my medical data, and I don't particularly like that idea. I mean, for all I know, there could be a lot of marketing that will come my way purely because that adds to my medical data, saying, you know, something dangerous, like try this drug and the drug might be completely untested and completely unsafe. So,
well, there's all sorts of reasons why somebody might maliciously wish to have your medical data, you know, so if they can just buy it from this database, sounds absolutely crazy. And as Philip Johnson makes absolutely clear there, although they're telling you it will all be anonymous, actually, they are telling porky pies, because it is possible for these companies to find out who you are just by looking at various things to do with where you are and what kind of medical conditions you've got, and cross-referencing it with other databases. Anyway, pretty frightening stuff. Now, I can't quite believe The next on the list to talk about is tax avoidance, because I've been trying to avoid it for weeks, Jason. Every week it's on our list, tax avoidance again.
Well, Tony, this is an issue that won't go away, and it's a very important issue.
We wish it would, but it won't. So what's the latest?
Yes, well, latest is, I'm afraid, really sad to hear, tech firms are making a last-minute bid to halt the clampdown on tax loopholes.
What? They're trying to halt the clampdown. So yeah. How are they doing that? This is, you're talking about Microsoft, I guess, and Google and people like that.
Google, Amazon, Apple and many others who pay less tax in the UK and elsewhere have launched a last-ditch attempt to derail plans devised by the G20 group of countries to close down international loopholes that they exploit. The Digital Economy Group, a lobbying group dominated by leading US digital firms, has written to the OECD, the Paris-based think tank, tasked by G20 with drawing up reforms.
That's the organisation. Yeah, look, I'm showing how smart I've been reading on the internet here. He says OECD is Organisation of Economic Cooperation and Development, and they're a think tank, European think tank.
Correct. And the Digital Economy Group has written to them saying...
Who is it again?
Digital Economy Group.
Digital Economy Group.
Yeah, this is the lobbying. This is the lobbying group representing Google and Amazon and people like that. They've been saying that it's not true that communication advances have allowed multinational groups to game national tax systems. I don't know how they aim to prove that they haven't. You know,
I suppose the idea is to throw doubt onto the discussion, isn't it, and to kind of manoeuvre the argument as to do we need to do anything or not, and then hopefully nothing will happen. That's what these lobbying groups seem to do. Any idea how much they've been paid? This lobbying group that instead of going to us in taxes was paid to the lobbying group, Jason?
I haven't seen anything here, but an interesting fact is that. Google, which is a member of the DEG, had been allowed to pay £3.4 million in tax to HMRC, that's Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, in 2012, despite tax revenues of £3.2 billion.
Gracious alive. So they're paying, just to remind us, so £3.2 billion in turnover or revenue, and how
only,
much?
Only £3.4 million in tax.
Okay, so that's... roughly 1/1000th of, so that's 0.1. I thought, hang on, corporation tax, isn't that supposed to be around about 30%? But they're somehow managing to pay 0.1%.
Less than that, actually, Tony.
Oh, no.
0.1%
no, no, no. Next time you click on to Google, remember that fact, that they just quite. Really aren't paying their tax. And who on earth is going to make them? Anyway, Tax Hero. Let's look on the bright side when it comes to tax, because you've got a story, Tax Hero, here. Now, is this Private Eye or The Eye?
No, this is
or,
the Eye.
Because you had a Guardian as
this
well,
is,
though,
didn't this you? Is The Eye on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Who covered this?
Tax Hero. This is great. Whoever it is, I think they should be given... Have they been given a OBE or in the Queen's Honours List?
I doubt it. They're doing something good for the public. No, but this guy is an absolute hero and putting one over the government.
So, okay, so what's he done?
This is the hero who beat the bedroom tax.
Really?
A loophole discovered by Peter Barker that will benefit thousands. It says here that he's Ian they label him as Ian Duncan Smith's nemesis, which I absolutely love.
You so know. He's found a legal loophole whereby the bedroom tax is in some cases illegal. Brilliant.
Yeah. He's found a loophole in the bedroom tax, which can mean up to 40,000 housing benefit claimants can claim money back. Overall, the controversial policy, which affects around 660,000 housing benefit claimants who are deemed to have one or more spare rooms, deducts up to £22 a week from their benefits. Mr. Barker discovered that people who have occupied the same property continuously and have taken housing benefit for it since 1996 should never have been included in the policy.
Oh dear. So aren't they naughty? So hounding people out of their homes who actually they didn't have no legal right to do that at all.
Yep. So those now eligible for a refund include people who are facing eviction or have been forced into move to smaller properties. Mr. Barker, who is a consultant on housing policy, put his findings on a blog called RightsNet and it instantly went viral. Now more than 10,000 people have viewed it, rather more than his usual blog audience of 200 or 300.
Okay, so just remind us, what is this chap's name and where's he from? Because he's a true hero.
He is, his name is Peter Barker. He's 53. He's from Romford in Essex.
Romford in Essex. Well done, Romford.
Hey.
Okay. Also, the council tax. There's lots and lots on tax this week. A council tax is hitting the poor. Now, I think that was always the idea of it, isn't it? And here, there's a little bit of an insight into the old council tax, Jason. Back in the 1980s, in Thatcher's time, when we had this thing called the poll tax, riots in London and various other things, I remember looking into at the time who it was that had actually drawn up the idea of the poll tax. Any ideas? You'd like to hazard a guess?
I have no idea.
Because it came out of some diseased brains. The whole point of the poll tax, of course, is to shift away the main burden of local taxation away from people with money. That is to say property owners, the owners of houses, onto the residents who often have no money. Now, this was a very regressive tax. And, of course, the original idea was that you wouldn't be able to vote unless you paid this tax, which many people simply could not afford to pay. So the idea was to shut them out from voting. So the poor wouldn't be voting. So this was actually a very positive idea, policy idea from the Conservatives. Now, two characters who were involved in drawing up the poll tax. One was a local Somerset resident, Lord Waldegrave, William Waldegrave, lives about 10-15 miles south of Bristol.
Was he not MP for Bristol West at one point?
I think he was. And also Victor Rothschild.
There you are, a Rothschild.
Lord Rothschild William Waldegrave got together somewhere and dreamt up this wonderful idea of the poll tax, gave it to Margaret Thatcher, and she said, wonderful.
Well, actually, the idea is centuries old because, of course, it was the
Peasants' Revolt.
It was a tax proposed by Richard II to fight wars with France and was opposed by, most famously, Wat Tyler, but probably more by Jack Straw, after who... John Whittaker Straw, the politician, took his name from.
Interesting. And interesting, isn't it, also that Jack Straw is a nickname for a worthless man.
Lol.
Anyway, quickly, the council tax is hitting the poor. What's the
story? Low-income families in deprived areas are bearing the brunt of government cuts in council tax benefits, according to research published today. Findings undermine the coalition's pledge that programme of austerity is hitting the better off rather than the poor. When council tax benefit was abolished last April, English local authorities were given the choice of asking low-income working-age families to pay more council tax or absorbing a 10% cut to central government funding itself. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, IFS, found the shake-up reduced entitlement for 2.5 million working households by an average of £160 in the current financial year. Of the 2 million working age households who previously had their bills met, 70% are now paying some council tax.
Well, this is a nasty little tax, isn't it? I was listening to Radio 4 this week, a very good programme, I think it was on Tuesday morning, which was talking about the poor laws and bread taxes. Originally, people couldn't actually afford to eat, rather like today, that the money that they were getting, agricultural labourers, just simply wasn't enough for them to feed the family. And so what they were doing is they were implementing the wages of the poor agricultural workers with a bit of money so they could afford to feed their families. Now, in those days, rents were very, very low. What the programme was saying was nowadays, the thing that is needed for to be subsidised is people's rents and people's housing. And so it's housing that people are having trouble with, although it's exactly the same kind of situation as it was hundreds of years ago in the poor laws. And their solution back in those days was for the workhouse. That is to say, basically, you're imprisoned in this place where you have to work every day. And that's, of course, what Oliver Twist was based on. These kind of corralling people into workhouses. Maybe that's what the Conservatives are thinking of.
I was going to ask, is that what you think is going to happen, Tony?
Well, who knows? But regressing back hundreds of years to hit the poor. I guess that wraps it up for this week. Jason, any final thoughts?
All I can say is that with the tax avoiding tech companies, all I can hope is that the G20 countries tell them to get stuffed.
Okay, let's hope so, yeah. All right, Jason, thanks very much. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2. If you're online, you can subscribe to our email list or download this weekly podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our studio guest David Moat from ASALT, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko and Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's 989 7733, and they're online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Thank you.